You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Tassida Dean. Tassida, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Hello.
Tassida, let's begin a little bit by talking about what you're working on at the moment. I know you're getting ready for a show, and you're probably just in the middle of installing it. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is? And I know you're at Marianne Goodman Gallery now. This is where the show is in New York. Can you tell us a little bit about the show, the title, and a little bit about what will actually happen there?
It's called My English Breath in Foreign Clouds, which is a quote from Shakespeare's Richard II. And it's actually a few works. So in the front gallery, I have a whole, what I call a concordance of 50 American clouds. I've been in L.A. for a year and a half. I was the artist in residence at the Getty last year, and I extended for another year. So I've been observing the clouds in Los Angeles. I know most people think there are no clouds, but there are extraordinary clouds there. And I mean, I'm obviously British, where clouds are grey and heavy and connected to rain, but in LA they're connected to wind in some mysterious way. So I've been kind of become a cloud watcher. So in combination with sort of a situation where I was offered these sort of Victorian era school slates, so I started to work with those. And but there are sort of several mediums in the front. There's lithography. I've painted over found cloud postcards. There's two blackboard drawings, and there's some overpainted photographs as well as these slate drawings. So that's in the front. I have a new film called Portraits, which is a portrait of David Hockney, the British painter, because he loves to smoke. He doesn't paint when doesn't smoke when he paints, but he smokes when he thinks and considers. And he's quite put out that, you know, there's such a hoo-ha about smoking, and especially in California. And he said, you know, it used to be that you couldn't be gay. Now you can't smoke. There's always something. So I filmed him smoking 5 cigarettes, and he's working on a series of portraits of, you know, people in LA, not just LA, but colleagues, friends, even his, you know, his gardener's kids, and or people who help. So it's very non-hierarchical, you know, and so they're surrounding him as he's smoking, so it's quite reflexive. So it's a portrait of him, and he's making portraits, so that's why it's called Portraits. I mean, 5 cigarettes, as well as all the portraits. So that's a 60 millimeter film on a loop.
And how long is that film?
Yeah, 16 minutes.
Oh, it's 16 minutes. I think you said 16 millimeter.
It is 16 minutes and 16 millimeter.
Right. That's kind of fascinating, and it's also very funny. It sounds like that piece in particular has a great sense of humor to it.
Well, yeah, and there are 5 in a way studies in a way, and the last one he is laughing. I mean, he's a really warm and wonderful man with a great sense of humor. Mm. He believes enormously in the power of laughter. Mm. So I have that one, and then I have a 33-minute, 16-millimeter film I made called Bonfresco, which was filmed in the Upper Basilica in Assisi. And it's using a macro lens and a sort of scaffolding, well, not scaffolding, what do you call it, a scissor lift, to film to film the real details of Giotto's frescoes of the life of St. Francis. So by, you know, really, really macro, so like fingernails and bits of rope and petals of flowers and you know, lips and mouths and all sorts of, and it really gives you, it's the eye of the artist, the perspective you don't normally get when you see the frescoes, which is very much when you're, standing on the floor of the basilica and looking up. So the detail was just incredible. I mean, the sort of technique and the economy of brush stroke and very kind of 20th century, actually, in many ways. So That's 33
meters. Well, it's also detail you wouldn't normally see. I mean, I've been there. That when you're on the scissor lift and doing, you know, macro lens imagery, those are also flowers and details that we would have never seen unless they were reproduced in kind of gatefold images in art books.
Yeah, no, but it was an incredible privilege, of course, to have that access. Mm. And it felt like it, actually, to be sort of nose-to-nose with, you know, St. Francis's nose, in a way.
Exactly. I know that whole area, you know, Assisi is quite gorgeous, one of my favorite places. Why, what was the genesis of that project? That seems so rich to me in many ways.
Well, I mean, I was a Roman Catholic, but I was sent to a Methodist school, and then therefore I had my Catholic education at the hands of these young Franciscan friars across the road in the University of Kent in England, in Canterbury. So I've always known a lot about St. Francis. And then I was invited to be part of an exhibition in Santiago de Compostela, which was 800 years since St. Francis's pilgrimage that he made to Santiago. And I immediately remember this, what I've always been very interested in, this moment between when the concept of sainthood became very humanized by St. Francis, at the same point when Giotto started to bring in naturalism in painting. Now, there's only, I think the frescoes were painted in 1296. You know, St. Francis died in the beginning of, I think it's 12, I've forgotten now, but the beginning of the 13th century. So, the death of St. Francis, his canonization, the building of the basilica, and the painting of the frescoes all happened in one century. So it was an escalation of the idea of all sorts of things, but definitely bringing in humanity, the human aspect. And, you know, it was the end of Byzantine painting and the beginning of the sort of naturalism that we still see today. So it was a really interesting moment, and you can see it in the combination of the brushstrokes. But I think the subject matter, of course, was perfect also.
Well, yeah, the subject matter in his life is kind of extraordinary, and it is interesting that all unfolded so fast. I remember, to me, yeah, he also seems kind of the most human of all the saints. I mean, when you're there, I forgot where it was in the basilica, but there's his robe that he wore, and it's an incredible relic when I saw it, but it was just sort of palpable how recent he actually lived.
I know, and if you actually travel at all around Italy, I mean, the paths that they're still there that he trod, and the places he slept in are still there. It's Yeah, I mean, his relation, you know, because I suppose he was a real presence and is still a real presence in Italy, which is not quite the case for some of these other saints who are sort of more like fictional characters. I mean, he really had a true existence and had a true life. And, of course, he was a very physical saint. You know, he rolled around in the snow to you know, squash his passion and all sorts of things like that. So you knew about his, you know, and it was always, you know, brother body, and, you know, very much about his body and his, you know.
Well, so something seems quite magical, too. I know, I mean, I just had this other memory of being there when you're looking at where, you know, in the CC, the paths, again, he trod and where he perhaps sat and laid, and there's white doves all around that area, it seems, endlessly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a very contemporary saint. You know.
Yeah. So now the context of all of this. So that's a gorgeous project, you know, and the clouds and David Hockney. Why that triangle? In a sense, they seem like such different subjects, such different aesthetics.
Well, actually, I mean, that's only half the show. I haven't even got down to the back of the gallery yet.
Okay, so keep going.
Well, and the back is a series of photographs I took of Cy Twombly's studio in Gaeta in Italy, which is sort of quite near Naples, in southern Italy, which is where Twombly lived, a beautiful house and his small studio. And I, in 2008, I made a photo essay, again using macro, and very, well, not radically so, but details of this, his house, And I've made them now into a photo series, in part because, you know, a lot to do with the sort of obsolescence of photochemical papers. Mm. I was offered some Cibachrome paper, and it was my last chance to, you know, use the slides that I'd made and turn them photochemically into images. So that was the beginning, and so the whole project is all, you know, hand-printed photochemical prints, and there's various different photographic mediums in the back. So there are 50 of those, and 50 clouds in the front. And then on the third floor, I have
But before you go on, I want to talk about the third floor. But Cy Twombly's studio, almost in relation to the what we were just talking about, Assisi. I mean, maybe this is a stretch, but as I recall, his studio there is also an extremely gorgeous studio, isn't it? Unusually so.
Well, it was a beautiful. It was an old kind of. I suppose Ottoman influence house, in the sense that it had an interior courtyard, and these rooms that followed with the Bay of Salana outside the window. I mean, these incredible sea outside on four or three sides, really stunning place, but full of his collection of, you know, anything from, you know, his sculptures and his, you know, objects he collected over the years. He was a, you know, from knickknacks and bits and pieces and stuff, because he was. Collected a lot of things, and it was just a wondrous place to be, also another great privilege to have been there. But of course there is connections between Bonfresco and Twombly, and for me Hockney, you know, My English Breath in Foreign Clouds is of course connects to Hockney's English Breath in Foreign Clouds also. So I mean, for me there are a lot of kind of formal and sort of narrative connections, even if they're not very kind of obvious ones. I mean, there are a lot of connections.
And the last piece of the show?
The last piece is called Event for a Stage. I mean, it is a slightly different work because it's on the third floor. It's a 50-minute film I made from a time when, a performance. I made a performance in Sydney, biennial in Sydney. I was given a stage for four performance nights, and I thought, well, I would try and work with an actor. It's not something I've ever done before, so I ended up working with this actor called Stephen Delane, and we had a very, very sort of fraught time in to do with what my assumptions about theatre were and what his assumptions about art were, which was quite a clash actually. Sure. And we ended up managing to. I mean, I was very interested in stage fright and self-consciousness, and I asked him if he'd ever had stage fright, and that sort of, you know, was the genesis for a whole sort of journey in a way. But I don't want to give too much away, but it's, you know, it's a piece that you have to see. It's a 60mm film, of course, again, and the film was, the two cameras were part of the stage, so it was filmed during the performance, but because it was film, it had to be, you know, film runs out every 10 minutes, so it was always punctured by this 10-minute break on, you know, for both of the cameras, and Stephen called the slates, you know, which means he had to tell which slate it was, instead of us doing it, which is what normally happens. So it became part of the sort of, you know, it was not very, it's part of it in a way. And then there were four nights and he wore four different wigs. And for the film, I cut the film from the four nights, and so it cuts between the four wigs and the four nights the whole way through. But it's something you have to sit down and watch. It's going to be shown every 90 minutes in the gallery until the end of March. So it's a 90 minutes. It's a 50-minute film, but every 90 minutes. So but you can't really walk in. You don't get the emotional trajectory if you come in the middle. So it's not like, you know, often like, for example, both Bonfresco and portraits are on loop systems actually they're cut so that you don't kind of, there's no fade up or fade down. You just can come in at any point and, you know, what you encounter is what you encounter. But there is definitely a trajectory in Event for a Stage. So we're doing it on screening times and with the hope that people will come in at the beginning and leave at the end rather than walk in the middle.
Right. Well, it is this theatrical, you know, it's this theatrical event. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you said earlier when you said initially collaborating with him, there's this kind of clash between theater and art, as I remember you saying. Can you speak a little bit to what is that clash? Because that's something that I think I'm familiar with, you know, perhaps as you may say it, but that there are these, even in the art world, between, you know, film and art and music and dance, there often seems to be these lines, whereas, you know, the visual arts sometimes sees things differently. How is it that there was a clash, or if you can speak to it in general?
Well,
I
had assumptions about theatre. I tried to begin, you know, we talked a fair amount before, and then I tried to write a script from our discussions, which, you know, clearly appalled him that I was handing him this flimsy, you know, apparatus within which to work, and were all my assumptions of how an actor behaves on stage. I mean, I really came from a point of ignorance. And he, on the other hand, thought that art, you know, an artist, meant that he would just sit doing nothing. You know, he had a sort of very generic idea of performance art, you know,
right,
that he would just have to sit doing nothing and we'd all observe him. And so it was like, and I said, no, you know, over my dead body, that's not at all what I want to do. I really want to explore what interests me about acting, which is the whole idea about how can an actor, you know, an actor is by very nature self-conscious, but how do you also not be self-conscious? I mean, what is the nature of self-consciousness on stage, and what happens when that breaks down, and all this stuff? And I learned a hell of a lot about theatre, really a lot, but in a very painful way. And then, you know, we had a hard time, but we resolved it in the end, and the whole process of the you know, became very much part of the stage production, and you know, that's what I can say without giving too much away.
Right. No, I don't want you to give it away, but I think that's very interesting that, you know, how you're describing an artist approaching it, or the way you're approaching it, as opposed to a traditional way an actor approaches it, or even these presumptions about what performance art is, or what an,
you see,
you know,
I didn't want to do performance art in what, you know, is generally understood as performance art. I really wanted to try my hand at theatre, you see. This is or what I thought or imagined theatre could be. So that was the point.
And between what you thought theatre was and what actually happened, what did you, I suppose, learn during that?
Well, that's why
that
you have
process
to come and see the film, because it's all laid bare.
Okay, very good. Fair enough. So it's exciting to have all of this together. This is a really kind of wonderful presentation of how you typically work in so many mediums, and also this is showing great breadth, it seems, of your...
Well, I mean, I was in L.A. last year at the Getty, and I got very involved because I'm trying very hard to protect the medium of film. So I put a lot of my effort into, you know, taking the problem to the industry in a way, and we had some success on that matter, but it meant that I was sort of kind of frustrated, so I'd rather enjoy going back to, you know, being an artist rather than just a campaigner. But it was important that I did it too. So this is a sort of return to, you know, just that sort of solitude of making things alone, and, you know, solitude, but, you know, working alone in your studio and trying to work with medium, because that's the whole point of, really actually a part of this show is to make a point about medium, because saying that film was is a medium and not a technology has been, you know, become highly charged and quite a political thing, because of course it is a medium to me, but it has been, you know, thrown away as a technology for the industry, and it's reclaiming its mediumness that is, you know, might mean that it has some chance of survival. So I wanted to make a point about, you know, mediums do things that you don't always intend. That's what's so important about them. And, you know, I'm using this spray chalk in the front gallery on these kind of, which is quite an inhospitable medium in a way, trying to get these slates to work in a way that, you know, chalk doesn't work on it. So I had to find a new way. And just letting it do things and, you know, being the guide in a way in everything it doesn't do as well as everything it does do is, of course, a great metaphor for how you also work with film and the importance of, you know, not always being in control. You know, things, amazing things happen if you let the medium work for itself. And unfortunately, you know, it's less easy to do that in our sort of digital universe, you know, because everything is so obvious, you know, you can see it all. But with film, you know, when I work with film, film goes into darkness and I lose sight of it and then it comes back and I can, and it's done something I didn't anticipate or didn't intend. And it's the lack of intention that I think is so valuable with film.
And, that's very exciting the way you say that. That sounds almost like the way, you know, printmaking has that effect, right? Monoprints, engravings, you don't quite get what you...
And even lithographs. I have lithographs in here. It's my first attempt at lithography, too. And, yeah, of course it does. It's the same thing.
So surprises. The medium gives you back something that you didn't really put into it. I never really thought of film like that, but that's true. You're saying because of the qualities of emulsion and silver and how that... Yeah. That reacts? Is that part of what you're saying?
Yeah, totally. You cannot always anticipate how the light will affect the crystals. And it's really a wonderful thing. And I use that a lot. I mean, there's so many times that the film has done something that I did not intend it to do, which has, you know, enabled me to take a whole other road. And that's the important thing about medium, and film does that, and we have to protect it. It's crazy to lose it as a medium when we've invented it and perfected it and loved it for over 100 years. So, you know, it pains me that we might be doing that, but I hope we've turned a corner. It feels like it a bit anyway.
Well, does it? I mean, that's an interesting place to leave off to... You know, because the show, even though you did this work at the Getty Center and other places, all contributing to the, you know, and you can speak to that a little bit now, perhaps the preservation of film as a medium, as a media. At the same
medium,
time, this
it's definitely not a media. That's the thing. This is another thing I'm trying to do now, because media, somehow that word has lost its meaning. It doesn't have.
Right. And you can have an outdated media, but as a medium that you can work with that has its own
qualities and properties. So that's why I pluralize,
and
you did too, interestingly enough. You pluralized the word medium. You said mediums to me, which is great, and because that's, I think, the best way to describe it now, or them. Or otherwise, if you say my media, it's lost its meaning. It doesn't mean, you know, it has too many other meanings. So I know I'm talking very much in terms of artistic mediums.
And how do you feel, you know, speaking kind of politically then about the issue or economically? You said it does seem like there's been some headway made in terms of what you've been talking about concerning film.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, even Kodak have re-embraced it now. They've committed to it. They've, you know, they're building a new Super 8 camera. We're going to remake Super 8 film. You know, they're seeing a market in the sort of frustration of sort of younger people who would love, you know, who miss the physicality of film. And you know, it is you know, as somebody said, it is like a pendulum. You know, it did go very, very far in one direction, and it's coming back now, and it does feel like it's coming back now. People are realizing, you know, that they are different. You know, that's all. It's very simple. They're just different. So we should make every effort to keep both. And, you know, digital does not have to mean the end of film. It does not have to mean it. They can coexist. And that's all we've been trying to say for a very, very long time. But there was of course, it's extremely capitalist. And, you know, a lot of people are invested in digital and didn't want to have film around anymore, and it is of course cynical in that sense, but you know, it's great that it's turning a corner. It does feel like it. I mean, the pessimism of 18 months ago or even was really scary, actually. And now,
well, it's interesting. Do you think it's comparable at all to the way we see vinyl? Vinyl was seen as something that was not going to exist anymore because specifically of digital media, and vinyl in terms of people buying music seems to be coming back with tremendous strength now.
Yeah, we actually have on the website, say, film.org, we have film is in its vinyl, not final age. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, vinyl is luckier than we are because it doesn't have to rely on industrial production in the way that film has to. Mm. So we do rely on Kodak making this stuff. You know, artisanal production won't really work. I mean, there are people that are working with, you know, making their own emulsions and grinding bones in the desert for gelatin, etc. But we need an industrial production for film. So that separates it slightly from vinyl. But, you know, we just have to make it profitable again and popular again and just normal, actually. That's all we need to do is make it normal. I mean, I have these Cibachromes. This is obviously photographic, but I have these Cibachromes in the back, which are was the way you made a slide, a transparency into a photograph photochemically. And they're just so beautiful. But that's the last, you know, that someone contacted me and said, do you want this? This is the last paper and chemicals we have in the world, in Switzerland. And I said, yes, no, I'll buy it. And they, you know, that's it. It's over now for Cibachrome. And it's so stupid because it's such a beautiful process.
Absolutely. I had no idea. That's quite upsetting to hear. That's something I had no idea about, you know, about that. And of course, that is a gorgeous process. And so that's part of this, the struggle for those processes not to be lost, because as you're saying, it can't be made in an artisanal way. That's an industrial process.
Yeah. They're very difficult.
Well, thank you for the you won?
I said they're very difficult and expensive to reinvent as well.
Well, I'm so glad for your work on behalf of that, because it certainly make me think much more about that and film itself. So in closing, it's exciting that you're having this show. It must be a thrill for you and putting all this together. This interview will be out during the course of the show. Is there anything you want to leave off on? It could be anything from making a note about the show that we haven't already. I was thinking that when you were talking about how that film should be seen, you know, even to leave it off on, and maybe I should, that to be sure that you come in at the beginning of the film as opposed to walking in at the middle. But is there anything else you want to leave us with about the show?
Well, to understand that it's all photochemical, I think it's quite important. Even the photographs in the back, that the amount of care and attention that goes into making photochemical images now is quite a lot. It's no longer easy. You know, I'm working with the last guy in Berlin and all these people, and keeping them in work actually. And it's really just to have a look at the physicality of the photographs and understand that they are different, that they have, there's a depth in photochemical, in film, and in photography, which is different from digital prints, I think.
Jessica, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and I wish you the very best with your show, and I hope all our listeners will come see it.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.